Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are discussing clergy abuse, so some of the content may be disturbing. Last August, a Pennsylvania grand jury revealed that more than 1,000 children were raped and molested by 300 so-called predator priests over the course of about 70 years in six Pennsylvania Roman Catholic dioceses. These findings came after officials spent more than 2 years scouring the records of the Pennsylvania Catholic Church. Since then, Pope Francis has issued a global order requiring that all Catholic priests and nuns report clergy sexual abuse and cover-ups to church authorities. This week, American bishops say they will address the sex abuse crisis at a conference, and a nationwide Associated Press query of more than 20 state and federal prosecutors last week found that they are looking for legal ways to hold religious leaders accountable for abuse. Their strategies include raiding offices, setting up victim tip lines, and investigating decades-old allegations. And then there's a new report that just came out. From 2011 through 2018, the U.S. Catholic Church spent $10.6 million on lobbyists to prevent victims of clerical sex abuse from suing for damages. For decades, the influence of the church has allowed it to escape scrutiny. A new report out from The Intercept reveals that abuse survivors allege presidential candidate Kamala Harris refused to take action against clergy members accused of sexually abusing children when it meant confronting one of the city's most powerful political institutions. Kamala Harris is former district attorney for San Francisco. The local advocacy group SNAP, Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, has been pressuring the Archdiocese of San Francisco to release its list of accused priests, as so many other archdioceses are doing. So how are efforts to bring justice to survivors of abuse developing, and how are local governments taking on this issue? Today we are joined by Melanie Sakota. She volunteers for the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests as the organization's East Bay leader. She's also a member of the board of directors. She is co-founder of the website, it's pokrov.org, that is a resource for survivors of abuse in the Eastern Rite churches. And you can find that website at yourcallradio.org. And Melanie joins us in studio. Hi, Melanie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
Well, it's great to have you back. There's just so much going on right now.
There is.
And you all are pressuring the Archdiocese of San Francisco to release its list of accused priests. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I understand that a lot of lists are being released. You just told me before the show that we just got a list out of Sacramento, California.
Yeah, Sacramento, I think a few weeks ago, and then the Franciscans, I believe it was the Franciscans, if I'm remembering correctly, a religious order released their lists. You know, before that it was the Jesuits. Fresno says they're going to release a list. They haven't yet. So it's just been one diocese after another, and a lot of new information coming out. In addition to the, you know, there's a resource called bishopaccountability.org that keeps track of all the Roman Catholic clergy nuns who abuse children, and yet there are names that we've never heard of before.
Wow.
Every time a new list comes out, so in that sense, we're wondering what in San Francisco would come out. And last week I was in front of St. Finbar in San Francisco, and a former priest there, now deceased, Father Kevin, I think it was Kevin Baugh, was never listed anywhere. He's not on Bishop Accountability. He's not on the report that Jeff Anderson, the sex abuse attorney, released about San Francisco. And his victim was there to say, in front of the church where he was abused, to say, I was abused here.
Wow.
By this man. And how many other names are there like that, you know?
What was the reaction when he said that?
The media that was there were very sort of startled, and, you know, he showed them this, you know, sort of took them to the side of the church where the rectory was and said, yes, that's where I was abused, and I went to this school, and, you know, it was just very sad, you know, that here's this man that's carried this burden. You know, he reported to the diocese. He actually reported at the time of his abuse, he reported to his teacher, and nothing saved him. Mm. So,
how are these lists compiled? What's the process involved?
You know, it's supposedly they usually have some either the what is it called the lay, you know, they have a lay review board that goes in there and looks, is given the records and then decides, oh, these are whatever word they use. Some dioceses use the word credible allegations. Some of them use that they're substantiated. What those terms mean varies from diocese to diocese. We're usually not given a definition, but and I like to put them in quotes because we don't know what they mean. And I would prefer that they would list all the priests that they know that have been accused. And they can say, you know, there's only one allegation and we didn't really find it credible. But if they don't put the name out there, somebody else who may have been abused by the same priest is not going to be able to say, oh, I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for the first victim to come forward to be the second victim, the third victim, the fourth victim. It's easier. So that's why they need to get those names out there, because they really haven't investigated until they've made a public announcement to the people that may have been affected.
What happens after these lists are released?
Sometimes, and I can't say that I've noticed this in California, but so they release the list and then you go to the website and it's like, well, where is it? They're really hard to find, which is one of my other pet peeves, is if you're going to have the list, it needs to be where, like, it's easy to find. It needs to be updated. You know, if you find out later that somebody else comes forward and you change an allegation from, you know, that it wasn't substantiated, and then someone else comes forward and it's substantiated, you need to update the list. And you need to update the list and announce it. Oakland recently updated their list after the Franciscan list came out, and nobody knew about it. You know, my friend and I were working on something, and we discovered it accidentally. And when we, you know, put out a statement the next day, and the press was saying, well, when did they update it? It's like, I don't know. We do. We were just looking on Sunday night, and there were all these additional names, because Dan kept saying, that name isn't on there. And I said, yes, it is. And he was looking at the old list, and I had gone onto the website and I was looking at the new list. So, you know, you need to announce it, because otherwise people aren't going to know that there's additional names on there. And I mean, I hate to be cynical, but I kind of think it's deliberate that they don't want people knowing how many clergy have abused. You know, that's why some of them limit it to, you know, they won't include order priests. You know,
what are order priests?
It's like the Jesuits, the Franciscans. They can work within a diocese, but they are also belong to the order, and they're sort of two separate organizational. So there's this big dispute as to who's responsible if they abuse in a parish.
Wow. And I'm not familiar at all with the hierarchy of the church.
Yeah, I'm not really either.
So, because it's interesting, we're going to talk about
not being
this.
Catholic. No.
Well, yeah. The government officials say that they're going to increase efforts to hold religious leaders accountable for abuse and hire up religious leaders. What does that mean exactly?
You know, I think they're looking, at least in California, from what I gathered from some of the things that have come out from the Attorney General's office, what they're looking at is, since I believe it was 1997, clergy in California are mandatory reporters of child sexual abuse. So when the question is, and there has been some question recently with Oakland about whether they immediately reported the recent allegations against Father Alex Castillo. And I think that's part of what they're looking at. You have all these names that have been hidden all these years. Is there some, did they violate some law, you know, by not reporting the names? If perhaps the victim assistance coordinator, whoever was handling it, was also a a counselor or something, she would also be a he or she would also be a mandatory reporter, even before the clergy became a mandatory reporter. So were they reporting, or were they doing everything in-house?
I'm sure, obviously, it varies from person to person. But when you talk to victims of clergy abuse, what does justice look like for them?
You know, in some ways, there's nothing that can bring back what they've lost.
Right.
And most of the survivors that I talk to, what they want is for this not to happen to another child. Mm. And, you know, they would like, I think, some of them want apologies from the church, because a lot of them were abused by men who the church knew had abused children previously. So they want an apology. And, you know, as I said, that no one can restore it, but I think it's nice for them to be compensated for some of their losses. You know, some of these people, it totally derailed their educational lives. Some of them, it threw them into mental illness or substance abuse. You know, these are people who have lost a lot, whose lives were changed. And it's nice to have the church acknowledge that by compensating them by some means, which I think is why it's so important for most survivors that the statute of limitations be changed, both for the future and that a window be opened so that people who are previously timed out by the statutes have an opportunity to say, this person abused me, and to tell their story in public.
Right. And because of all of these stories and these explosive news reports, are we seeing changes in the statutes of limitations?
There's been quite a few. Recently, I think the most recent one was Vermont to change it, and before that, it was New York and New Jersey. California has one in the legislature that passed last year, but Governor Brown vetoed it. And so they're hoping that it'll pass this year, and it's my understanding that they're not expecting a veto from Governor Newsom.
What was the explanation from Governor Brown?
Just basically, it was, I don't remember what he said last year, but the time before that, when there was a bill, he just basically, he said exactly what the Catholic Church had said. Well, you know, there has to be a time when all this is put to bed, and, you know, witnesses die, and, you know, but the fact of the matter is that delay is usually in favor of the people who are defending themselves, so that, you know, the person coming forward still has to submit the same amount of proof in order to prevail. It just gives them an opportunity.
Right. Melanie Sakota is our guest today, and she volunteers with the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, as the organization's East Bay leader. And today we are talking about ongoing efforts to hold religious institutions accountable for clergy abuse. If you are a survivor, what does justice look like for you? And if you'd like to share your story, you can always do it anonymously. We would love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And has your area, wherever you live, has the archdiocese in your area released a list? And if so, what has been done about it? Have prosecutors in your area been proactive about pursuing criminal charges against alleged abusers? A little later in the show, we will speak with Lee Fong of The Intercept about his piece. He wrote about survivors accusing Kamala Harris of failing to pursue charges against abusive clergy members during her time as San Francisco's district attorney. Melanie, what have you heard back from the Archdiocese of San Francisco? Your group has been pressuring them to release their list of accused priests.
No.
No response at all.
No, we don't really expect one. I think As I recall, the Archbishop has said he's considering it, but unlike some of the other, he hasn't laid out. You know, Fresno has said, we brought in these outside consultants and we're turning the records over to them, and you know, when they're done, we'll release the list. I don't think there's been anything like that from San Francisco, at least not that I've heard of. I'm not sure why. You know, just different personalities, I guess, maybe. And
we're going to talk with Lee Fong in about 10 or so minutes. Can you just talk about the influence of the Catholic Church in San Francisco? How powerful is it?
You know, that's kind of, I'm not a native of this area, so it's a little out of my area. But, you know, from what I understand, it's been very powerful. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of influence, and I know I was talking to, I can't remember who it was the other day, I was talking to someone that, you know, supposedly as a, you know, a religious organization, nonprofit, you know, they shouldn't be telling people how to vote, but I think they tend to do it, so that you have a very powerful block, you know, that can be delivered. You have influential people that can donate money to campaigns.
Right.
So I think in San Francisco, being, you know, a lot of Irish and Italian immigrants, Hispanic, you know, there's a lot of people who are connected to the Catholic Church.
Well, we just did get a new report out recently. NBC News reported last week on a report commissioned by a group of law firms, which found that the U.S. Catholic Church spent $10.6 million on lobbyists to prevent victims of clerical sex abuse from suing for damages. And they spent the money from 2011 through 2018 in 8 northeastern states where bills to reform statute of limitation laws were either in the works or being considered.
Yes. And, you know, there are some people who think that $10 billion is...
$10 million.
$10 million, yeah, is an undercount.
Right.
You know, that what they actually spent more. They've spent money out here in California also to help defeat statute of limitation reform. So they've thrown their money at this issue. And the sad thing to me, especially as I said, you know, I wasn't raised Catholic, is that when they do that, they prevent all survivors from having their day in court, not just Catholic survivors. And I think they're doing it to protect, partially to protect their assets, yes, but I think even more so to protect the information that they're trying to keep hidden.
In Pennsylvania, where victims of child sex abuse can come forward with criminal allegations until the age of 50 and can file civil claims until age 30, the church spent just over $5 million to keep those limitations in place.
Yeah. And in Pennsylvania, they have succeeded so far. I mean, I think they're going to try again this year, but they were unsuccessful in New York and New Jersey. Those reforms passed. And that was the other thing that they're doing in Pennsylvania now, and they did in New York, was they set up these compensation programs. And California has recently set up the same sort of, you know, that abuse victims who are beyond the statute of limitations can go to the diocese where they were abused and apply for these compensation programs. There's two problems with that. I mean, for some people, it's a great thing, you know, especially older people, you know, who may not have time to wait until the end of a civil case, which can take years in the courts. But the problem with them is that the information is not necessarily released. The compensation programs in New York, if the victim wanted to say, I just got compensation because I was abused by Father so-and-so, they were entitled to. But the church said, no, we're not releasing that information. So again, it's trying to hide who was abusing, where they were abusing, how long they were abusing. And the victims are not going to get as much money from these programs as they might if they waited for statute of limitations reform and filed a lawsuit. And as I said, for some people don't want the, going through a lawsuit is very difficult. And, you know, some people just know, I'll take my little bit of money. But I think it was actually an effort to prevent the statute of limitations reform, you know, to say, okay, look, we're taking care of these people. You don't have to reform the statute of limitations. But the trouble is, then it keeps a lot of information hidden.
Hmm.
And you know, the extent of their complicity in what happened, not that they were all abusing, but that people knew and covered it up.
And you can find the report from NBC about the Catholic Church spending $10 million on lobbying to stymie priest sex abuse suits. Today, we are talking with Melanie Sakota. She volunteers with SNAP, Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, as the organization's East Bay leader. SNAP has a hotline, and whenever we do shows about this, our guests, including you, Melanie, say that any time this issue is in the news, which it is today because of this American Bishops Conference, and then just recently on May 30th, NPR ran a story called Survivors of Sexual Abuse by Nuns Want Yes. Greater Visibility for Their Accusations. It was a pretty in-depth piece. And you have said in the past that any time these kinds of stories run, the calls to your hotline start to go up.
Well, I should say it is not a hotline. It is a helpline.
A helpline.
It's not manned. It is a volunteers call in to pick up the messages. I think we have a okay. different volunteer every day. And yes, you know, the calls increase when, you know, you have a lot of activity. Like there's been a lot of information allegations coming out of the Diocese of Fresno recently. And you'll have people, you know, either contacting us either through the helpline or if they go on and find, you know, like my contact information or Joey Piscatelli's or Dan McNevin or some of the people down in Southern California, you know, we'll get calls. You know, I was abused by that person too. I've never told anybody, you know. You know, I was abused. I told the diocese when it happened. Or I told the diocese when I was 21. I told them when I was 30. And wondering why nothing was ever done, you know. So it's very, in some ways, I mean, it's sad that all these people have been carrying this burden all these years. And but I'm always so glad when they start to let go of it a little, to realize that it's not their fault, that they weren't the only ones.
So you can call into the number, and the number is 877-762-7432. It's 877-SNAP-HEALS, and then leave your story, and then someone will get back to you.
Exactly. And we do get a lot of hang-up calls, who I think people who think it's a hotline, and then they don't get an answer. But no, it's just leave your message. Someone will get back to you. We have people, very conscientious people, who pick up the messages every day, and will either return your call or they will, if you tell them, like, say, I was abused in the Diocese of San Francisco, they'll refer you to one of the local leaders. So you'll get someone who's in your area.
Again, that number is 877-762-7432, 877-SNAP-HEALS. And today we are joined by Melanie Sakota. She volunteers for SNAP as the organization's East Bay leader, that survivors network for those abused by priests. She's also co-founder of the website. It's pokrov.org, a resource for survivors of abuse in the Eastern Rite churches. And coming up after a break, we will also be joined by Lee Fong, an investigative reporter for The Intercept. He recently published a story called "As San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris's Office Stopped Cooperating with Victims of Catholic Church Child Abuse." This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Moms Demand Action founder Shannon Watts about her new book, Fight Like a Mother, how a grassroots movement took on the gun lobby and why women will change the world. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you were tuning in thinking that you were going to hear a story about why so many horses are dying on U.S. racetracks, we decided to postpone postpone that show to focus on this issue today, but we will be talking about that in the coming weeks. Today, we are speaking with Melanie Sakota. She volunteers for SNAP as the organization's East Bay Leader, Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests. And in a couple minutes, we will be joined by Lee Fong, an investigative reporter for The Intercept. He recently wrote a story called "As San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris's Office Stopped Cooperating with Victims of Catholic Church Child Abuse." Before we bring on Lee, he and The Intercept put together a video clip of this story. And so we're going to play a clip from that. And in this clip, you will hear from Joey Piscatelli, a sexual assault survivor who a jury had found had been molested as a student while attending a college prep Catholic high school in Richmond, California. And here is that clip.
I was accepted to Salesian High School, which to me was an honor. Almost immediately after I got to the high school, I was befriended by the vice principal, Father Steve Whelan. The very first incident, I was playing pool, and he masturbated in front of me. And I was scared to death. I stood there frozen. I was just a little 70-pound runt. I looked across the room, and I thought, geez, I need some help. And Brother Sal Belanti was watching and enjoying it. And later I found out he was a serial molester rapist himself. When he got out of the PE to go into the showers, he would watch me. He would make comments about me undressing. Then he started calling me into his office and telling me I was bad in class and what am I going to do for him. And then he would attack me. He would stick his hands down my pants. He would just molest me. And then he would tell me if anything happened, nobody would believe my word against the priest. And I believed him. This escalated. He started getting more violent and more rough. And the very last time he attacked me, he dragged me into the room. I actually blacked out and floated away while he was molesting and raping me. I just gave up on Catholicism. I gave up on God. I lost all sense of spirituality. I went with another victim to Terrence Hallinan's office, the DA's office in San Francisco, and we were introduced to Hallinan and another DA's assistant, who told us they virtually had all these boxes, about like a room full of files that they had gathered and collected and subpoenaed from the Diocese of San Francisco on all these priests. Bishop Levada at that time was the highest ranking bishop in the United States. Then he became cardinal. So this was the top guy. This was the kingpin in the United States. And we had a champion here that was going to go after him. We thought, well, this is going to go somewhere. These guys are going to be punished. They're going to be held accountable. They're going to be prosecuted. In 2004, Kamala Harris was elected. Everything just went down the tubes. Everything he did to gather information and to try and prosecute and go after them disappeared and went the other way. She shielded and protected them, and we were floored at what happened.
And that is a clip from an investigation by The Intercept. The voice you heard there was Joey Piscatelli, a sexual assault survivor who a jury found had been molested as a student while attending Salesian College Prep, a Catholic high school in Richmond, California. And now I would like to welcome Lee Fong to the show. He is the reporter who wrote that story about Kamala Harris, who was then San Francisco's district attorney. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Rose, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Lee. I should say we're also joined in studio by Melanie Sakota. She volunteers with SNAP, Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, as the organization's East Bay leader. Lee, you interviewed a number of survivors, specifically talking about Joey, since we just played that clip. How did you connect with Joey and learn about his story?
Well, I should say that my story builds upon very important and thorough reporting from SF Weekly, Ron Russell and Matt Smith, reporters that used to work at that newspaper, the Alternative Weekly in San Francisco. And so in researching the story and looking at all the players and individuals involved, part of that was looking at that older reporting And they had spoken to Joey, so that's one of the ways I got in touch with Joey.
You show how the San Francisco Weekly revealed that shortly after being elected as district attorney, Kamala Harris worked with church officials and other prosecutors to conceal clergy records, choosing to only divulge clergy abuse files over the course of a criminal investigation. And several California prosecutors signed a controversial protocol at the time with the Catholic Church to conceal similar sexual abuse documents. Can you talk more about that?
Well, the actual protocol that was signed, and this was back in 2004, 2005, we don't have a copy of. I mean, I made a records request to some of these DAs, including the San Francisco DA, for a copy of that protocol. Unfortunately, they said that they could not locate it, that it was likely stored in some off-site location, and they were unable to find those files. Also, in addition, some of those files were allegedly disclosed through the course of litigation in Marin County, but Marin County, after 5 years, when there's a case dismissed, destroys documents relating to a case. So we don't have a copy of that protocol, but we can look at reporting throughout California at the time. This was very controversial. Many prosecutors throughout California, especially in Southern California, criticized this attempt by some DAs to conceal these records, to sign some type of protocol that gave the Catholic Church sway over how these records were released. I wish we had more information to discuss this protocol and a copy of it. But we know that ultimately many of the DAs, including Kamala Harris, declined to release or disclose any of these clergy abuse files, likely in relation to this protocol.
Lee, you report that when Kamala Harris became San Francisco District Attorney in 2004, she took over an office that had been working closely with survivors of sexual abuse to pursue cases against the Catholic Church. The office and the survivors were in the middle of a legal battle to hold predatory priests accountable, and Kamala Harris inherited a collection of personnel files involving allegations of sexual abuse by priests and employees of the San Francisco Archdiocese, which oversees church operations in San Francisco, Marin, and San Mateo counties. And these are the files that were compiled by investigators working under Terrence Hallinan, the DA who Harris ousted in a contentious election campaign. So what happened with those files?
Well, we have to put ourselves back in 2002. Throughout the 90s, there had been a number of high-profile criminal investigations of individual priests working in Portland, in Miami, Chicago, Baltimore, you know, all over the country, but there really hadn't been a comprehensive look at how some of the prominent archdioceses had known about these credible allegations against priests, paid off and silenced victims, and moved known predator priests and other members of the clergy from parish to parish, and essentially facilitated decades of abuse. And we really didn't see a clear view of this system of abuse until the Boston Globe story on the Boston Archdiocese, showing that more than 70 priests under the Boston Archdiocese were known sexual abusers who had molested children, who had raped children, and that the Boston Archdiocese had facilitated the movement of these priests around the country, particularly in the Boston area, and never reported them to law enforcement. Now, that those shocking revelations led to a number of DAs, in particular San Francisco's DA at the time, Terrence Hallinan, who was known as one of the most radical district attorneys in America at the time. He's very similar to individuals that are now in the news, like Larry Krasner of Philadelphia. You know, he really kind of bucked what would many usually view as the role of the DA. Instead of working very closely with police and large institutions to go after low-level criminals, he kind of flipped the job of the DA upside down, instead focusing on investigating the police, investigating powerful institutions, corporations, and politicians, and then focusing on reentry and criminal justice reform for low-income offenders. So he's a very controversial figure at the time, but he said after this Boston Globe story came out, he wanted to make the to investigate the San Francisco Archdiocese to look carefully at 70 years of personnel files. And once he subpoenaed the San Francisco Archdiocese, he obtained large numbers of files that showed that there were internal records, letters, other credible accusations against many priests and clergy members that worked in the San Francisco Archdiocese. And he quickly went to work issuing criminal indictments for a number of those members of the clergy and other priests for molestation and rape. And these files, which were never made public, but were used by the grand jury to make some of these indictments, were very controversial at the time. People criticized Hallahan for making a fishing expedition. The San Francisco Chronicle attacked him for making a broad investigation into the church. But the files showed that high levels of, or allegedly showed that high levels of the San Francisco Archdiocese knew about these credible accusations and did nothing. They did not report these priests to law enforcement. In fact, they continued moving them around the San Francisco Bay Area, to Santa Rosa, to the East Bay, and all around, continuing to pay them and put them in places where they would continue to work with children.
And Kamala Harris's office refused to release these files to the public. Is that right?
That's right. During the course of these investigations and these lawsuits, in 2003, Kamala Harris came out of nowhere, backed by the San Francisco establishment, to take on Hallahan in a very close election. She pushed Hallahan to a runoff and then soundly defeated him in a runoff in the end of 2003. So she came into office in 2004, and many of the victims and survivors of clergy abuse who had worked with Hallahan's office, they say they had been promised access to these files, that these files could be used in civil litigation against alleged predator priests. And they say that Harris's office switched gears, where Hallahan had offered both formal and informal assistance to these survivors. Harris's office then changed course and declined to even meet with these clergy abuse victims and declined to release the files. Hallahan said these files were a matter of public record, but Harris said that they weren't and refused to release them. The San Francisco Weekly, of course, later filed a Freedom of Information Act request and filed a lawsuit, but they were declined. This came up again in 2010 when Kamala Harris ran for Attorney General. Again, she declined to release these files, this time making the argument that doing so would harm the victims, even though many victims said that you could redact the names, you could protect the names of victims, but they wanted these documents released.
Melanie, what do you make of this? Joey Piscitelli, the sexual assault survivor that we heard in the clip, told Lee that, quote, if it went from Terrence Hallahan going 100 miles an hour, full speed ahead, after the Catholic Church, to Kamala Harris doing absolutely nothing and taking it backwards 100 miles an hour, end quote.
You know, this is a little before my time with SNAP, but from what I know Joey, and I know Dominic, the other person that's mentioned in Lee's article, and some other of the survivors that were around at the time. They were all extremely, extremely upset and disappointed. You know, this was information that could help to perhaps, if it came out into the public, maybe these cases were beyond the statute of limitations for some people, but if the names came out, there may be somebody who was within the statute. They could have started, you know, taking action against some of these predators, and that's why they, you know, and some of them, like I know Joey wanted the files to see if there was anything about his perpetrator. So, you know, it was just crushing. And, you know, survivors are people who've already been betrayed. Mm. And I think that it was like a blow to the gut. And they haven't forgiven her.
Lee, what else did survivors tell you about working with Kamala Harris's office compared to working with her predecessor, Terrence Hallahan?
They said they were incredibly disappointed. Several survivors who had met on a regular basis with Hallinan's office were just surprised and taken aback that Harris had changed gears. Some of them said that, you know, that they had also received a hostile reception from the former mayor, Willie Brown, and they perceived Harris's disposition in at least in implicit support of the Catholic Church to be part of that political alignment in San Francisco. It's not really clear to them why she changed gears. Maybe there was too much political power at play that she didn't want to upset a powerful political institution like the Catholic Church. It's not really clear why she changed gears. In addition, Joey and other victims, in fact, handed out flyers all throughout the city. They stood outside of the district attorney's office in downtown San Francisco and flyered the attorneys and assistant DAs as they walked to work to try to beg for a meeting, essentially. They went and picketed outside of then-Archbishop Lovato's office in San Francisco, really to continue to call attention to this issue and to demand some level of accountability. But again, they never received a formal meeting with Harris, and of course, they never received those files.
Lee Fong is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. We are talking about his story called "As San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris's Office Stopped Cooperating with Victims of Catholic Church Child Abuse." We're also joined by Melanie Sakota. She volunteers with SNAP as the organization's East Bay leader. She's also the founder of the website pokrov.org. a resource for survivors of abuse in the Eastern Rite churches. And you can give us a call if you have any comments or questions, if you have any stories to share, at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And let's hear from Don in Oakland. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Let me turn off the radio. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Go ahead.
Good. Why would anyone bring this matter to the attention of the district attorney in San Francisco when Salesian High School is in Richmond, which is really, it's in Contra Costa County? And so that would be, I think, under the auspices of the Catholic Archdiocese of Oakland. So why would they be not bringing it there? I don't understand that.
Lee, do you want to take that?
Yeah, that's right. Salesian High School is in Richmond, and Piscatelli's lawsuit was in Contra Costa County, but his abuser, Stephen Whelan, had moved from working in Richmond to Peter and Paul Church in San Francisco. And other members of the Salesian High School faculty who also allegedly engaged in abuse, including another person named Sal Bilitente, who worked at that high school, was also transferred to a church in San Francisco, where he allegedly also molested children in San Francisco. And in fact, under Terrence Hallinan, Bilitente was indicted under a criminal indictment for molestation that he engaged in San Francisco. So what Piscatelli was hoping for was that given the movement of these priests and these members of the clergy throughout the Bay Area, including working in Catholic institutions inside of San Francisco, some of these allegations against the priests were perhaps sent to high-level Catholic church officials within San Francisco, or that San Francisco church leadership were in any way aware of the allegations of their conduct in the East Bay, and he was hoping to see those files.
Hmm. Anything to add, Melanie?
No, I was just saying that, or just what Lee said was that these priests were transferred and they were in San Francisco, and it makes sense to see if there were records here too, because the records probably might have moved with them. So it's entirely reasonable that they wanted to see what was in. And some of the records, like Dominic DeLuca, who was the other person that was mentioned in the article, His abuse, I believe, was in the San Francisco Archdiocese. And so these were people, you know, some of the other people were within the diocese, and Joey had a perfectly valid reason, he and his attorney, for wanting to see if there was anything in these files.
According to Lee's article, Dominic DeLuca, a Burlingame, California resident, says he was raped by a local priest when he was 12 years old. He said he was shocked that Kamala Harris declined to aggressively pursue clergy abuse cases and refused to release the files. He said, quote, "I remember Kamala Harris. She didn't want to have any meetings. She wanted the public to think this is an issue that happened years ago, that it doesn't happen anymore. Let's just move on," end quote. Lee, you reached out to Kamala Harris, and you haven't heard back. Did they send you any kind of statement?
No, she did not. Not her office did not, or nor did her press staff. Just completely ignored many emails and other forms of contact to the campaign. So I think that's unfortunate. I think the public deserves to hear her side of the story and where she stands beyond her statement back in 2010, saying that, you know, releasing any files would harm victims.
Well, and you write that, you know, Kamala Harris has made fighting on behalf of victims of sexual abuse, particularly children, central to her political identity. I mean, she's been doing this for the better part of three decades.
Yeah, that's right. You know, right out of law school, she went and was working in Alameda County as an assistant DA, and she's focused on child sex crimes. When she ran for DA against Hallinan, she highlighted victims of sexual abuse and prostitution and other sex crimes, pimps that she had prosecuted in the past. And then when she ran for attorney general, one of her first television advertisements, it's linked in the piece, I think in the second or third paragraph, features an ad showing a number of what, you know, some kind of stereotype of a sexual deviant storming into a family's house and then going to the children's room to surround a child. And then Kamala goes on screen and says, you know, I'm going to fight back against online predators who target children. So, you know, a big part of her political biography is her argument that as a prosecutor, she has fought to take on the tough sex abuse crimes as a public prosecutor. So I think this is a very important part of her biography and something that deserves more scrutiny.
Melanie, we were briefly talking about the power of the church earlier, and several survivors of abuse told Lee Fong that they believed Kamala Harris declined to release these files in deference to the church. In fact, Dominic DeLuca said, quote, "The Roman Catholic Church is very powerful, and I think they didn't want to step on any toes, especially in San Francisco."
Yeah. It's unfortunate, and, you know, it's sad to me that someone who's, you know, saying she wants to protect children won't protect children in a particular class, which is Catholic children. And, you know, I'm hoping that maybe she'll look at some of this publicity, and, you know, she's a senator now. She's running or trying to run for president. You know, she's going to be in a position at the federal level perhaps to take a change of course, a change of heart.
Well, let's hear from another caller just quickly. Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
I was raised a Catholic, and I didn't experience this kind of stuff, but I'm sorry for the feedback. This disqualifies Harris, as far as I'm concerned, to run for president. I mean, this is just so disturbing to hear this. I can't even imagine it. And if this becomes more public, I just think she should withdraw. I just don't think this qualifies her to be a candidate at all for the presidency. So thanks for the program.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Lee, are you planning to continue to reach out to Harris's office? We should say that she did not respond to your requests.
Well, if she does have a response and wants to engage in this subject in a substantive way, I'm happy to add that to the piece or do an additional piece. So hopefully I can be in contact with her campaign. Of course, I'm covering all the Democratic presidential candidates. I'm writing multiple stories. I'll definitely be reaching out to them again for other stories. Hopefully we can talk again about this. And, for folks who are interested in this subject, I just want to note that there are attorneys general all across the country now, finally, after decades and decades of doing very little, are actually doing exactly what Terrence Hallinan did back in 2002, and that's requesting decades of personnel files. The Pennsylvania Attorney General has been the most aggressive. He recently released a 900-page report showing those basically the exact same type of files that Hallinan requested, but from the Pennsylvania area archdiocese, and it shows just really just breathtaking information. Letters from priests and principals at Catholic high schools and other Catholic institutions saying that, you know, their colleagues have been accused by parents of raping and molesting children on their facilities, and that these priests, instead of the high level church officials reporting these priests to law enforcement, these priests were moved all throughout Pennsylvania, were moved out of state, and this happened. And the records go on from the 60s all the way through the early 90s. It was a systematic cover up, and you know, there's never really been a systematic investigation and prosecution of the Catholic Church in covering up these types of crimes. It's really only been individual priests who have been prosecuted for molestation and rape. Never a systemic look at the Catholic Church as an institution covering up and facilitating these types of crimes.
Mm. Melanie, what are your thoughts on these efforts? Do you think that anything will come of this?
This is a major change. I think it's the most hopeful thing that's happened for abuse survivors since the Boston Globe report, because this is where you're going to find out, you know, it's going to be revealed, because the Catholic Church has a habit of talking about a few bad apples. Just a few bad apples. The problem is not the few bad apples. The problem is the people who covered up for them, and there's a lot more of them than just the few bad apples. And that's what people really need to see, is the systemic problem, not just the, you know, you can find molesters anywhere there's children.
Melanie Sakota volunteers with SNAP, the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, as the organization's East Bay leader. Melanie, thank you for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
Lee Fong is investigative reporter for The Intercept. You can find his story as San Francisco DA Kamala Harris's office stopped cooperating with victims of Catholic Church child abuse at yourcallradio.org. Lee, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose. Take care.
Thank you. You too. And thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and David Latulipe, our studio engineer. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we will speak with Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action. She's out with a new book called Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.